Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record 397, titled The Virtual State and Machiavellian Politics. This is being recorded on February 2nd of the year 2003, and before I get into the typically complex conversational topic or investigative topic of this program, let me refer you to Spitfire and their website, specifically spitfirelist.com, and the For the Record section, which will have a detailed, annotated article-length description of For the Record 397 within a week or so of the recording of this program. Also, linked to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website are two websites maintained by sister station WFMU-FM. The more recent For the Record programs are streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery. Older For the Record programs are available for download only at a longer URL linked to both the For the Record section of the Spitfire website and to the other WFMU URL. By the way, radio stations that would like to air the For the Record program should contact Spitfire, and tapes or CDs will be sent to them free of charge. Now, we're going to be focusing on what is conceptualized in the For the Record broadcasts as the virtual state. That definition was coined by Philip Bobbitt, a political scientist with long and deep connections to the elements of the national security establishment. Research credit on this goes to a listener. This is a reprise from For the Record 393. This is from the Austin American Statesman of Monday, December 2nd of 2002, an article by Sharon Jason headlined, UT, that's University of Texas professor, has finger on pulse of warfare. The shield of Achilles, war, peace, and the course of history, is Philip Bobbitt's daunting 919 pages about the transformation of war. It's filled with political theory, it's laced with portraits of key diplomatic figures, it's pages upon pages that discuss the differences between what he terms the nation state and the market state, and the emergence of the virtual state, represented by Al-Qaeda as an enemy organization without a definable location. His book was already at the publisher before the September 11th terrorist attacks, so Bobbitt added a post-attack epilogue. Now, in For the Record 393, I stress that in addition to Al-Qaeda, what I have alluded to as the Underground Reich is quite literally a virtual state. It's a Third Reich gone underground at the end of World War II and transformed through a physical and fiscal diaspora into a virtual state. And what we're going to be looking at in the broadcast today is the presence of the virtual state in diametrically, lethally opposing ethnic groups and national groups, as well as in diametrically opposed ideological groups as well. I can appreciate that many listeners will find many of the focal points of For the Record difficult to understand. Remember Machiavelli and remember the virtual state. And one of the things that makes the virtual state so deadly, so effective, and so elusive is the very fact that it not only exists in polyethnic environments, it exists in poly-ideological environments, and it has an agenda which is Machiavellian. In the first part of the broadcast, we're going to be taking a look at the presence of the virtual, of the underground state, of the underground Reich, excuse me, the virtual state of the underground Reich in the Israeli right and its influence within Israel. And we're also going to review briefly the influence of the underground Reich and that virtual state within the Islamo-fascist and secular Arabo-fascist movement as well. Because with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, we are looking at a classic Machiavellian application of the virtual state and the underground Reich. We're also going to be taking a look at the underground Reich's presence in elements of the left, and specifically on both sides of the war versus peace question in Iraq, and also the globalization movement as well. Sort of the overall scenario that I'm advancing here is one of let's you and him fight. If you can get groups to destroy each other, it leaves the instigator of the battle alone and unchallenged at the end of the struggle. I also want to emphasize very, very strongly that when I talk, for example, about Germany using, or the Underground Reich using proxy war in the Middle East, this is not to be misunderstood as implying that the sentiments of the German people on behalf of peace are anything less than sincere. Indeed, the German people do have a profound awareness of war and its dangers and peace, but the German institutions learned something very, very different at the end of World Wars I and II, which is that basically, even though their own population was sacrificed, they could survive because the German corporations and also the German intelligencers and the military survived at the termination of both world wars and prospered as a result. So when I talk about the underground Reich, this is not in any way to impugn the very real sincerity of the German people on behalf of peace, but rather to suggest that the underground Reich is something very different. It is a virtual state, and the German corporations and military learned something very, very different from both world wars. But that's a point I want to stress, and in the admittedly complex themes that I'm dealing with on this program, that could easily become eclipsed. Now, first, I want to review briefly a couple of elements of the presence of the virtual state of the underground Reich within the secular Arabo-fascist elements and within the Islamo-fascist movement, reviewing very briefly something we've spoken about before, reading now from The Beast Reawakens by Martin A. Lee, published in hardcover by Little Brown Books, copyright 1997. We're going to be taking a look at a mission that was sent by the Galen spy organization and the CIA to the Middle East, in which Otto Skorzeny, the SS colonel and commando extraordinaire of the Third Reich, was utilized as a CIA/Galen contract agent and was in charge of setting up the intelligence service and the general staff of the fledgling German army or Egyptian army and intelligence service under Nasser. It's worth noting that as the events that we're describing here were taking place, Otto Skorzeny was also a kingpin in the arms trade and the head of the Odessa, the post-World War II SS underground that was one of the main enforcing elements of the underground Reich. One of Otto Skorzeny's protégés, and as we view the underground Reich and the virtual state that it is on both sides of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, we should bear in mind who one of Yasser Arafat's mentors was. Of course, Yasser Arafat is the head of the PLO. Remember that the PLO is financed primarily by Saudi Arabia, and the Palestinian Authority is financed primarily by the European Union, chiefly Germany. Turning to The Beast Reawakens of the Skorzeny mission to the Middle East and Skorzeny's adoption of Arafat as a protege, several young Palestinian refugees, including Yasser Arafat, joined the Egyptian soldiers who were learning the ways and means of unconventional warfare from Skorzeny. Although initially the intended target was the British, the future PLO chief realized that rigorous commando exercises would help to prepare the Palestinian militants who were eager to renew the battle for their lost homeland. A grateful Arafat recognized Skorzeny's abundant skills in this area, and the two men struck up a relationship that lasted for many years. Apparently, the Palestinian leader was quite fond of the scar-faced paladin. "Arafat would have done anything for Otto," remarked Ilse Skorzeny. Also reviewing briefly from what is arguably the best book about September 11th, a book published in French in 1999 and in English in 2000, 2 and 1 year respectively, before September 11th, we're going to review the transfer of the Muslim Brotherhood to Munich in Germany by Saeed Ramadan, the son-in-law of Hassan al-Banna, who succeeded Hassan al-Banna as the head of the Islamo-fascist Muslim Brotherhood, which, as we've looked at in many broadcasts, was allied with fascist Italy and Nazi Germany. An Egyptian parliamentary deputy, Saeed Ramadan, discusses Saeed Ramadan's relocation of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood to Germany. This pivotal role in the redeployment of the fraternity, played abroad by Saeed Ramadan, was also emphasized by Rifat Saeed, a deputy of the Egyptian left. Quote, "Before he settled in Europe, he made long sojourns in Saudi Arabia with King Faisal, then in Pakistan, where he worked with lawyers on the Islamic right. But by the end of the 1950s, he opened a new door by selling the Saudis on the idea of the Dawah, i.e. the propagation of Islam, especially in Europe. Thus, he proposed to them initially to open a center in Munich. Why Munich? Why Germany, I asked Rifat Said. Quote, because there, one finds old complicities that go back to the late 1930s when the Muslim Brothers collaborated with the agents of Nazi Germany. And furthermore, Turkish immigration to Germany had started to become an important phenomenon. By soaking up the savings of these Muslim workers, Yusef Nada, like Saeed Ramadan, took advantage of an extremely favorable context and used it as a springboard for the Muslim Brothers' economic activities. For these various reasons, the Munich Center quickly became very important, adds the Egyptian deputy. And again, Mustafa Yusef Nada, one of the principal figures in the Operation Green Quest investigation and a backer of Al-Qaeda, worked as a German intelligence agent in World War II, according to Dollars for Terror. So in assessing the Machiavellian politics of the virtual state that is the underground Reich, utilizing, in my opinion, the Muslim Brotherhood and related elements such as Al-Qaeda and Hamas as extensions, it's important to understand not only that in the presence of the secular Arabo-fascist and worldwide Islamo-fascist movement, one finds the underground Reich, but one of the most inflammatory facts for the Muslim world is, of course, the existence of Israel. And it's worth understanding that the underground Reich and fascism are present in the Israeli right wing as well, and that through their economic connections, through which they have helped to support Israel, they are present in the Israeli situation as well. They're on both sides of this conflict. We're going to turn now again to review the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, authored by Paul Manning. A biography of Paul Manning is available on the professional biography at for the record section of SpitfireList.com. And we're going to, first of all, review a little bit about the Bormann organization. That was the Third Reich gone underground, and with its power centered in corporations and in the German, in the Nazi/Odessa milieu of Heinrich Müller, the former Gestapo chief, and Reinhard Gehlen. After a synopsis of the Bormann organization, we're then going to examine the Bormann relationship not only to the worldwide Jewish business community, but also to the Israeli right as well. And by the way, just as I do not want to be misunderstood as characterizing Islam as fascist when I talk about Islamo-fascism, I don't want to be misunderstood as characterizing Zionism as fascist either. But with both, it is important to understand that there is a very significant fascist presence within Zionism and within Islam and the secular Arab states, and that, in my opinion, the long-term goal is to provoke them into annihilating and or subjugating each other. Of the Bormann organization, Paul Manning writes, with the war years far behind him, Martin Bormann goes on and on, quietly making history in worldwide financial circles. He was 80 on June 17th of 1980, and his chief of security, Heinrich Müller, was 79 the same year. Mart Bormann today may be likened to the classic chairman of the board of a vast international business complex, of an organization holding greater assets than any private investment house on Wall Street. Bormann, by the way, this book was published in 81 in hardcover by Lyle Stewart, so that's the time frame here. Bormann, aged though he is, continues to guide the destiny of his financial empire. But he is sufficiently prudent and foresighted to realize that the assets he controls must be placed in younger hands, and today the leadership council of the senior NSDAP group is reflected in a younger generation comprising professional managers, lawyers, and financiers who are calling the shots as money and trade are moved among the markets of the Americas and Europe. Their organization holds the bearer bonds that give him a voice in banks and industries of Germany, and likewise, they hold blue-chip stocks in U.S. heavy industries and chemical companies. They are represented, too, on the board of corporations, they are represented, too, on the boards of corporations in France, Belgium, Holland, Sweden, Luxembourg, and Switzerland, as well as a myriad of other countries, including those in their bastion, Latin America. Their management is of the best, and the companies they operate return a profit to everyone involved, from the West German government in corporate taxes and increased trade, to the shareholders of all companies that participated so long ago in Reichsleiter Bormann's flight capital program. Now, of the Bormann influence in the world Jewish community and in Israel, since the founding of Israel, the Federal Republic of Germany has paid out 85.3 billion marks by the end of 1977 to survivors of the Holocaust. East Germany ignores any such liability, and from South America, where payment must be made with subtlety, the Bormann organization has made a substantial contribution. It has drawn many of the brightest Jewish businessmen into a participatory role in the development of many of its corporations, and many of these Jews share their prosperity most generously with Israel. If their proposals are sound, they are even provided with a specially dispensed venture capital fund. I spoke with one Jewish businessman in Hartford, Connecticut. He had arrived there quite unknown several years before our conversation, but with Bormann money as his leverage. Today, he is more than a millionaire, a quiet leader in his community with a certain share of his profits earmarked, as always, for his venture capital benefactors. This has taken place in many other instances across America and demonstrates how Bormann's people operate in the contemporary commercial world, in contrast to the fanciful nonsense with which Nazis are described in so much, quote, literature, unquote. So much emphasis is placed on select Jewish participation in Bormann companies that when Adolf Eichmann was seized and taken to Tel Aviv to stand trial, it produced a shockwave in the Jewish and German communities of Buenos Aires. Jewish leaders informed the Israeli authorities in no uncertain terms that this must never happen again because a repetition would permanently rupture relations with the Germans of Latin America, as well as with the Bormann organization, and cut off the flow of Jewish money to Israel. It never happened again, and the pursuit of Bormann quieted down at the request of those Jewish leaders. He is residing in an Argentinian safe haven protected by the most efficient German infrastructure in history, as well as by all those whose prosperity depends on his well-being. Personal invitation is the only way to reach him. By the way, I would interject that with the anti-fascist and anti-Nazi focus of this program, and in particular with the use of the book The Secret War Against the Jews by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, I have been accused by many sometimes of being the tool of the international Zionist, blah, 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 blah. The only official response I've ever had to my work from a Jewish organization was to get investigated by the ADL as part of the ADL spying scandal in the late 80s and early 90s. I can't help but wonder to what extent that might have something to do with this protection of the flow of Bormann money to Israel, among other things. Now, a very interesting anecdote about the Bormann influence in Israel concerns Meyer Lansky, the American underworld chief who eventually found, at least for a while, diplomatic safe haven in and legal safe haven in Israel. Continuing with Martin Bormann, Nazi in exile, a revealing insight into this international financial and industrial network was given me by a member of the Bormann organization residing in West Germany. Meyer Lansky, he said, the financial advisor to the Las Vegas-Miami underworld, sent a message to Bormann through my West German SS contact. Lansky promised that if he received a piece of Bormann's actions, he would keep the Israeli agents off Bormann's back. Quote, "I have a very good relation with the Israeli secret police," was his claim, although he was to be kicked out of Israel later when his presence became too noted, and also at the urging of Bormann's security chief in South America. At the time, Lansky was in the penthouse suite of Jerusalem's King David Hotel, in which he owned stock. He had fled to Israel to evade a U.S. federal warrant for his arrest. He sent his message to Bormann through his bagman in Switzerland, John Pullman, who also wanted in the United States on a federal warrant. Lansky told Pullman to make this offer, quote, "which he can't refuse," unquote, the he here being Bormann. The offer was forwarded to Buenos Aires, where it was greeted with laughter. When the laughter died down, it was replaced with action. Meyer Lansky was evicted from Israel and was told by Swiss authorities to stay out of their country as well, so he flew to South America. There, he offered any president who would give him asylum a cool $1 million in cash. He was turned down everywhere and had to continue his flight to Miami, where U.S. Marshals alerted were waiting to take him into custody. The Borman Organization has the ultimate in clout and substance, and no one can tamper with it. I have been told, quote, "You cannot push these people. If you do, it can be extremely risky," unquote. Knowing their heritage, I take this statement at face value. So again, in attempting to understand the Israeli-Palestinian imbroglio, it's worth understanding that one finds the virtual state of the underground Reich on both sides. In my opinion, basically, Israel is a concentration camp, not yet a death camp like Auschwitz. Originally, the term concentration camp was coined to allude to the herding together of concentrations of population. It actually, the formal coining of the term goes to the British conduct in the Boer War around the turn of the last century. Auschwitz became an extermination camp. To make a very long story short, and to sort of sum up the history of Israel, the Zionist movement had existed for quite some time, but it was really after the rise of Hitler that it began to gain steam, because initially, before the final solution to the Jewish problem, the liquidation of European Jewry, elements of the SS and elements of the Zionist movement actually cooperated in order to promote Jewish emigration from Europe to Palestine. And it wasn't until the mid-1930s, after the rise of Hitler, that the Zionist movement really began to represent a demographic, serious demographic influence in that part of the world. Then, after the war, after World War II, was when the Zionist movement really reached its inertial maximum, so to speak. And basically, the surviving Jews of Europe, who had no place to go to and nothing to go back to, because their property had been appropriated, many of them also were from areas occupied by the former Soviet Union, wound up in the Middle East, specifically in what was to become Israel, for basically lack of any place else to go. Other countries didn't want them in. Then, after the War of Independence, they did indeed forcibly expel many of the Palestinians. It should also be noted that some of the Palestinians left voluntarily, simply because they felt that the Grand Mufti's armies would sweep the Jews into the sea. Some of the Palestinians, particularly the more moderate Palestinians, were forced out or liquidated by the Grand Mufti's Arabo-fascist goons, because basically they were collaborating with the Zionists. Then, after the Israeli War of Independence, many Middle Eastern nations, including Iraq, Syria, and Libya, expelled all of the Jews from their population and appropriated their property as well. It's one of the reasons why most Israelis appear to be of Middle Eastern extraction. In fact, they are. They are the descendants of the former Jewish residents of many of those Arab countries. That's basically where the situation stands to this day. And I want to briefly outline the fascist history of the right wing of the Likud party as well. There has always been a fascist element within the Zionist movement. I've talked about it in Miscellaneous Archive Show M30, Miscellaneous Archive Show M58. It's also discussed in For the Record 94 and For the Record 139. The main fascist element within the Zionist movement was called the Beitar. It was headed up by a guy named Vladimir Yabotinsky, and they basically were fascist Zionists, and there were actually pitched battles in the streets of Tel Aviv in the 1930s and 40s between elements of the Beitar and socialist Zionists as well. Israel was founded to a considerable extent by doctrinaire socialists. The Beitar was headed up by Vladimir Yabotinsky, the head of the fascist element within the Zionist movement. And in Italy, for example, there were strong institutional connections between Mussolini and elements of the Beitar. In fact, the Beitar took military training at Mussolini's Naval Cadet School, and Mussolini himself reviewed the Beitar cadets in 1935. Vladimir Yabotinsky's personal secretary and a pallbearer at his funeral was Benzion Netanyahu, the father and political mentor of Benjamin Netanyahu, who went on to become a prime minister of Israel. The two best-known Beitar graduates, other than Benzion Netanyahu, who again is the political mentor to Benjamin Netanyahu, the two best-known graduates of the Beitar are Meir Kahane, the right-wing American rabbi, and also Menachem Begin, of another former prime minister of Israel as well. There also was an even more right-wing element within the Zionist movement, the Stern Gang, which for a period of time advocated a military alliance between the Zionist movement and Nazi Germany to drive the British out of Palestine and to resettle European Jews from Germany into Israel. As discussed in the miscellaneous archive show M30, Otto von Bolschwing, a key Galen operative and Eichmann's superior, actually formed an alliance with a Polish Jew named Fievel Polkesch, who was a Haganah agent who worked with the SS. I would also note that there is a very interesting danse macabre that was conducted by the Republican Reich and the Underground Reich and the virtual state, that is, the Underground Reich is present in a big way in the Republican Party, and in particular in the Bush administrations. The Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization was not only a repository for key elements of the Eastern European and Central European fascist movements allied with Nazi Germany. It also has become a repository for Islamo-fascist elements associated with former Abwehr agent Youssef Nader. And yet the Islamo-fascist movement is also violently opposed to Zionism as well. During Bill Clinton's administration, when Bill Clinton was actively promoting an attempt to mediate a peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians under the Oslo Accords, the Republican right, and Newt Gingrich in particular, were actively courting the Israeli right wing. In fact, while Clinton was attempting to broker the Oslo Accords, and right after Hillary Clinton made a public statement in favor of the establishment of a Palestinian state, Newt Gingrich, in what was basically an act of treason, traveled to Israel and gave an address to the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, in which he completely undermined Bill Clinton's policy in that part of the world. It should also be noted that the Republicans, during the Clinton administration's, passed an amendment to move the United States Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, something that Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin advised against, because Rabin basically saw the moving of the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem as provocative. It's worth noting, of course, that in November of 1995, Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated. The aforementioned Benjamin Netanyahu, who succeeded Rabin and who narrowly won the Israeli election, Netanyahu came very close to being incited, indicted for incitement in the assassination of Rabin. Interestingly, Bill Clinton vetoed the Dole Amendment, so one of many things that Clinton has not been given credit for. Turning again to Dollars for Terror, and this is the last item we'll talk about on this side, Richard LaBaviere writes, "Indeed, constitutionally, the president can suspend the application of a law approved by Congress if he judges it contrary to the higher interests of the country, as was the case for the Dole law that proposed to transfer the embassy of the United States to Jerusalem." We're going to continue our analysis of the Underground Reich, the Palestinian question, and Machiavellian politics. Spitfire, www.spitfirelist.com. We'll have an article-length description of this program within a week or so of the broadcast. Also note that sister station WFMU has done us all a big service by archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery. Older shows available at a longer URL linked to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website and to the WFMU.org/Dave Emery website. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 397, The Virtual State and Machiavellian Politics, being recorded on February 2nd of 2003. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.